This is Unbroken, healing through storytelling. Just to let you know, we have a vodcast on YouTube where you can watch the edited highlights of the episode. And don't forget to subscribe. If you fancy the full audio version, simples, just keep listening. Oh, and if you've got a second, please give us 5 stars and a review. It really helps us stand out and get this important message to even more people that need to hear it the most. Meantime, enjoy today's episode.
Unbroken, healing through storytelling.
They wanted me to hate. And unbroken to me is standing up for what my family believed in.
Stories to heal and motivate.
Mike comes from a family very proud of their assorted military history, stretching back over generations. Mike served in the Royal Air Force along with his brother, father, uncle, while his mother served in the Royal Navy. He's best known for his campaign, Global Acts of Unity. This campaign began after his brother David was murdered by ISIS in Syria in 2014. David was a humanitarian worker who, whilst working with an NGO in Syria, was captured and held for 18 months before being horrifically murdered and his death put on the internet. In the immediate aftermath of his brother's death, he felt strongly that he did not want innocent Muslim people to be blamed and or victimized in his name. Mike made a television appeal for unity and tolerance. That was, in essence, the beginning of the campaign. Mike has and is working with HM Forces, local and national police, and many other organisations in the UK and abroad. Mike is a board member of the NGO ACTED and is one of the founder members of Survivors Against Terror. Mike has also been honoured with meeting the Pope and various religious and world leaders. He and his good lady were invited to the Royal Garden Party last year. In recognition of the campaign's work, Mike has been awarded an OBE in the 2000 Queen's Birthday Honours List. Mike is often seen on news programmes after a terror instance where he speaks against acting in hatred.
I have what I call my head and heart problem. When I emotionally react to something, I always muck it up. I knew that I had to stand against the hatred. The reaction I got from the students, 1,400 teenagers, silent, many in tears.
So welcome, Mike. I'm delighted to have you here on my very first podcast episode. You are my first guest, and it's just a pleasure to speak to you. I'm really very moved by the work that you are doing.
Honoured. Thank you, Madeline, as I am with you.
My first question to you, Mike, is what does the word unbroken mean to you?
My brother's murder was about hatred. They wanted to spread hatred, discord, and division in our communities. They were looking and in many respects broke my family. Mm-hmm. My mother died not long after my brother was murdered. She gave up on life. My dad's dementia got so much worse in the 48 hours when we told him of David's murder that I lost 75% of my dad. Mm-hmm. They took my brother's life. They wanted to break me and my family. They wanted me to hate. And unbroken to me is standing up for what my family believed in, the values that my mum and dad gave us when we were children, and what is right for the country, what is good for the country.
It's so good for the country and for humanity too, because as you say, if you did fill your heart with hate, then they would have won.
All the extremists, and I don't just mean jihadists, I mean far right and everything in between, they want to destroy what is good about this country. There's many things wrong with our country, but we are in a process, a road of where those things are getting better. And they want to destroy that. They want to destroy the inclusivity that we have. They want to destroy the diversity in faith, in culture. And we can't let them.
And did you come to this place straight away? Were you never filled with hate to start with?
On the night my brother was murdered, just a few days before, and I'd moved most of our family to my home. We'd filled the 13th of September full of family, love, laughter, and hope that David would come home. There had been a massive outcry around the world, and we hoped that this would have an effect on the terrorists. We'd all gone to our beds. It was 3 minutes past 11 at night. I'm sat on the side of my bed and the phone rang, and I knew at that time of night it was not going to be good.
It was such a brutal execution, and then it was put on the internet. It's so understandable why you were filled with so much rage.
Somebody could have flicked a switch and I would have gone to Syria. I would have done it. My family would have lost another son. I have what I call my head and heart problem. When I emotionally react to something, I always muck it up. So I tried to think about why they murdered my brother. And when it came down to it, there was a realization. It was like a bolt of lightning. It was about hatred.
Yeah.
What they wanted me to do, what they wanted my family to do, was to stand up, to point a finger to innocent people, an innocent religion, and say, your faith, your people killed my brother. And of course, that was rubbish. Mm-hmm. These were extremists who had taken a holy book and turned it for their purposes. I knew at that point, tears were rolling down our faces. My mum was sobbing. I knew that I had to stand against the hatred that they wanted to bring into my family, into my country, you know, into the world. I had to do something about that.
Quite quickly after he was executed, that you went on TV to speak out against hate.
Yeah, I did an interview with the BBC that ended up going out worldwide. Literally millions of people saw it. And it was, unfortunately, I asked for there to be no reprisals against innocent Muslim people. Unfortunately, there were. We know from talking with the police that there had been reprisals against innocent people. And my brother would have turned in his grave knowing that innocent people would have been hurt for his death.
And I'm also wondering what it must have felt like to grieve so publicly along with everybody else, to have your grief, you know, publicised.
We had the press camped outside our front door. It really was quite terrible.
Yeah.
Our police liaison officers were absolutely superb, and quickly judged when I had lost my temper and intervened and got rid of the press as quickly as they could. Which I'm glad for my sake.
Absolutely. Well, I imagine it's the last thing you need. You're grieving the most awful murder. It's been publicised and you have the press hounding you as well.
When David appeared in the video of the murder of Stephen Sotloff, it took 13 minutes for the press to arrive at my elderly parents' front door, banging on the front door. And this was after 11 o'clock at night. And luckily, my dad's dementia had kicked in a bit and he went to the front door, opened the front door and said, no, thank you, not tonight, and closed the door on them, not even realising that it was press.
That was fortunate, really, that he was able to do that without realising what was taking place. But for you, that must have been tough.
It was the intrusiveness of the press, who there were elements of the press, reporters who stood for honour and integrity and who were superb. And there were elements of the press who tried all sorts of trickery. And even when doing an interview where they would try to push to get that emotional soundbite or that headline script that they could use that would not be positive, they were looking for hate.
And that's something that you've never given.
I had realized in those moments after telling my family that hatred was not the way to go, that the best way to stand against the extremists, the terrorists, was through standing up and speaking for diversity, speaking for inclusion, speaking for peace, hope, understanding between communities. And that has been my message, you know, ever since. When I first started, I thought I was one of very few people who were talking for diversity, who were talking for inclusion, for understanding. And this past 6 years has been a journey of enlightenment, coming across people very much like yourself, who are working away in communities, who are doing such amazing work. At the moment, the voices of hatred are loud. The politics of hatred are loud. But there is an equal power of strength of people who are working in their communities for understanding, for faith, for hope, for the future.
But you do talk about having compassion for people that have been corrupted and are influenced, that go out to join these courses. I have heard you say that.
Very much so. The process, especially now during this time of COVID, this process where extremists sit in a small room and they very much, and I use the word purposefully, groom youth to join extremist groups for whatever purpose, whatever ethos. And it is going on. And actually, these children that go out to Syria to fight for ISIS, who commit terrorist atrocities, they have the power of choice. But these groomers are very clever, and they make these disenfranchised youth believe that this country hates them, that that the people of our country hates them. And we don't.
It really sounds like brainwashing, doesn't it?
It very much is. It very much is.
Yeah. So when did you start your global acts of unity? When has that been around? How long has that been around for?
I knew very early on that I had to do something, but I didn't know what. And I had been invited to a multi-faith event with the Oxford Foundation in Birmingham. They had organised this multi-faith event, and it was maybe 50 people there, and they were very much a friendly audience. And Manoah Hussain had said to me, "Mike, will you speak?" And I said, no chance, I'm not publicly speaking, I don't do that. And he eventually persuaded me to speak, and I got it down to 90 seconds.
90 seconds?
It worked very well. 90 seconds, you know, hardly enough time to even give my name. Afterwards, in the meet and greet, this gentleman came up and tapped me on the shoulder, and he says, "Mike, what are you doing tomorrow?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "Will you come to my school? I'm a headmaster." And in my head, I'm going, what does he want me to go to his school for? Shake a few hands, maybe eat a school dinner, meet you know, some of the students. So we arranged to meet, and I turned up at the school, and he was there, and we walked into the assembly room, and there were 1,400 students. I had never spoken before. I had no presentation. I had no notes. And I don't, to this day, I couldn't tell you what I said. But
I
know.
Last longer than the 90 seconds?
Yeah. I just opened my mouth and spoke from the heart. And it seemed to have a fantastic effect. And it was at that point, the reaction that I got from the students, 1,400 teenagers, silent, many in tears, And it was afterwards, when the students were coming up and talking to me, that I realized that this was my audience. These were the people of our future, the leaders of our country, of our politics, of society, of all sorts of different things. And these were the people that we needed to reach, not people of my age. So that was when Global Access Unity came into being.
You go to speak to schools mainly, and young people?
Yes, it's well over 90% schools. I go to an area and I do a cluster. I stay there for a week or 2 weeks and speak at as many schools as I can. We are well over 100,000 people.
Wow.
It had been my aim right at the start was to, if I could help one person understand that hatred was a choice, then we had won. I was not telling them not to hate. Hate is a natural emotion. But what I was saying was, you don't have to hate. You can choose not to hate, to act in hate.
What is their reaction to you? What kind of questions do these young people ask you? Because I imagine they wouldn't hold back. They would just speak freely, or freer than adults, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, very much so. It's a 50-50. You never know when you visit a school, and it doesn't matter whether it's an inner city slum school with no money, whether it's a posh school that is got everything, or a faith school or anything, you never know. And when it comes to question time, you either get hundreds of hands go up and loads of questions, and the questions they always surprise me, because I've never had a question about the mechanics of my brother's death. What I've had is geopolitical questions. What I've had is family emotion questions. What I've had is how do we fight questions. Not the sort of questions that you would expect. Our youth are amazing, and they are incredibly switched on and have such an understanding of the world, of our place in the world. And it is fantastic honour. And right the way through the presentation, from when we first start, the presentation is in two parts. The first part of the presentation, I'm telling the story of, I want to tell you a story of two brothers. Mm-hmm. And I'm showing family slides, typically out of focus, not straight, family photos. And I take it up to the point of where he was murdered. And then I say, I had to tell our mum, our dad, our family, that he had been, when he had been taken. And you can see that it hits them.
Yeah.
And then there's that tension. There is that going up to the point of his murder.
Because we hear about these things, and I think they feel far away, but when they meet someone who is so closely related to someone that has been so sadly involved with it all, it must just be mind-blowing to them.
It's wonderful. The amount of letters that we have from teachers saying, we've never seen our students this quiet. Mm-hmm. And I speak quite a lot at pupil referral units, the bad boy schools, and it's just the same there. I get the same response. You can see them when they walk in. I like to wear a three-piece suit with a bow tie and a pocket watch, and old-fashioned in that aspect. Mm-hmm. And they can see as I walk in, oh, crikey, who's this fat old bugger and what's he going to bore us with? And then as I'm showing photos of David and I's childhood, you can see an inquisitivity from them, curiosity. And then, of course, when I told them about him being taken, you can see anger and fear, and right up to the point of when he is murdered. And it is just the tension in the room, the emotion in the room is incredible. And then on the second part of the presentation, it's all about hatred as a choice, that they don't have to hate. And what I use, without saying it, is if I don't hate the people who murdered my brother, how can you hate someone who calls you a name? Yeah. You know, who steals your crisps, who does whatever.
Absolutely.
And absolutely. I'd say that without saying it. And it is amazing. I am still in touch with schools and students that I first spoke at, and the effect of the presentation and the Global Axis Unity visit is still there.
And on your website, you can read responses that children have written to the letters, and they are so moving, you know, when they talk about the impact it had on them. And I noticed on the website that you run a poetry competition as well.
Last year, I was at school in Kinross. Kirkcaldy, up here in Scotland. And this student, I was doing two presentations, one either side of lunchtime, and I'm sat with teachers and some students in the cafeteria area, and this young girl ran up to me, shut the bit of paper in my hand, and then disappeared before I could open it. It was the most beautiful poem. It's actually up on my wall.
Can you read it to us, or is that too much to ask to read it without just set you off completely?
No, I couldn't.
You can't, okay.
I couldn't. It was absolutely amazing. And then I have an enjoyment of poetry. My knowledge is nothing, but I have an enjoyment of poetry. And it came about, well, what about if we tried to bring in poetry into the campaign? And that's where Words of Unity came about. I wanted to know what unity meant to them. We had hoped for maybe 150 poems. We got close to 2,500.
Wow.
It was incredible. It was such a delightful but hard chore to whittle down the poems down to a sizable group that the final panel of judges that we could sit and say, right, this is the winner. And actually, when it came to it, when the judges and I sat down and we talked about all the poems, we had a group of 30, and pretty much the final poem chose itself, which is on the website. And it just speaks volumes. And I'm still getting part of the reason for doing a poem was my brother's murder was an act of destruction. What they do, what they preach, and I mean all extremists, is an act of destruction. Writing a poem is an act of creation. They have a blank piece of paper in front of them, and they have to take something from their mind and put it down on paper. It stands in defiance against the acts of destruction that the terrorists and extremists wish to bring into our.
Get the sense that every child, young person that gives you a poem or gives you a comment or asks you a question is like, it's another support for you and your campaign, or it's another win for David as well.
Very, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so.
And it's
and It is. And we're actually going to bring a collection of these poems out for sale so that the public can see the works of our youth. Mm-hmm. And they are amazing, absolutely amazing.
And like you, I love reading poetry, but I can't write it. But I'm amazed at their creativity. So good. But yeah, as you say, it almost seems like now that this is your life purpose, that you won't do anything else now apart from standing up against hate.
That's very much true. Mm. I run World Works in Unity and organise. And this, as you say, is my life now. Yeah. And I will continue doing this to the day I drop. Hopefully not in a school. That would just be so bad. I will continue doing this. And it gives me... there are a number of reasons that I do this. One is that it's in me, it's part of my family DNA. Mm-hmm. That we have to fight. We were all servicemen going back hundreds of years. And part of it is I can't go into the field and do the work that my brother did as a humanitarian worker. And the other reason is that I can't stand back and watch these extremists bring hatred into our communities.
But am I right in thinking that you did go back to Syria and you did visit the areas where David did do his humanitarian work?
I have stood on the border of Syria. I have travelled in the Arabic world, Islamic world, quite a bit. With ACTED, the agency my brother worked for. It was his daughter, Bethany, who took the trip to Syria. I can't go because I'm very much a target.
Okay. Oh, so they would come after you. That's a real fear then if you were to visit.
We do have security issues.
It must have still, even just to go to the border, that must have just been a very intense trip for you as well.
It was, I was in Jordan and I was visiting the refugee camps, and it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Like, I didn't go there and say, my brother was murdered by ISIS. I went there and I walked amongst the refugee camp, speaking to people, never at any time felt threatened, worried, concerned. And I asked people about their journeys. And on the website, there is, I have a blog. And on that blog is a bit about my trip to Jordan. Mm-hmm. And there's a photo of me with a gentleman, an Arabic gentleman. And he was quite incredible. We could only communicate through a translator, but we got on so well. And it turned out that he had been, escaped from Syria. He was a taxi cab company owner. He had a nice life, a nice big house. He was married, had five children. He had his mum staying in the house. He also had her mum, his wife's mum and dad, staying in the house. So they were good. And he escaped Syria with one daughter, one son, everybody else killed. And I felt this is the point. And then it turned out that some of it was down to ISIS and the likes of ISIS, and some of it was down to American bombs. And I, at that point, I went, oh, hell, this is where I'm going to face anger. This is where I'm going to face hatred. And he didn't express any of that. And then when he was he asked me, why are you here? You know, what are you doing here? And I told him my story. He was in tears for my family. And I found that wherever I went within the refugee camps, that when it came round to telling my story, these people who had lost everything were in tears for my family. My brother chose to go to Syria. He went there to help people less fortunate than themselves. He lost his life. That, in many ways, that was part of the job. But the compassion, the friendship that I received was, that my family received, was incredible. And even in the mountains of Afghanistan, I was lucky enough to visit Afghanistan, and small villages, and the compassion and friendship and warmth that I received from the people there was incredible.
I do essentially believe there are more good people than there are bad people.
Oh, yes. Mm. Oh, yes. Unfortunately, the press likes to point its attention at those who, the bad people. Mm. You know, and I, like you, I firmly believe, and I know for a fact that there are far more good in this world than there is bad.
Well, you have the evidence. You were meeting the goodness and the compassion and the heart of these people, and it resonates with you because that's what you do. You work, you're heart-centered. You work from your heart. You've always been led from your heart and your compassion for your family and for others. It's really very needed but beautiful and important work that you do. So just before we finish up, I'd just like to ask you, just if anybody's listening, but I don't know, if they're stuck in hatred, can't move on, what tips you would give them? You know, what helped you to really remain unbroken?
The simple thing that we can all do, and it doesn't matter what, we all, in all walks of life, have difficulties, have trauma of one form or another. The thing that we can do, the most important thing in the world, is an act of kindness. Acts of kindness have been proven to help your well-being, to help your mental health. During this current time of COVID is even more important. And we are seeing all across the nation and the world, people who are supporting one another through simple acts of kindness. And that is the secret. If you can choose to give someone, some people, some culture, some faith, kindness, that rolls on until it's a chain that wraps round the world with love, compassion, and hope.
Well, that is a beautiful message to end on. So I am just so grateful, Mike. Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak to me.
Thank you very much, Marilyn.
Unbroken, healing through storytelling. If you haven't already, go on, download, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating. It really helps us get this important and life-changing message out to as many people as possible. There is already a selection of fantastic episodes to choose from, and a brand new one coming soon.
Unbroken, healing through storytelling. Playing now on all the main platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher for Android, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and here. Play Unbroken, the podcast, with Madeline Black.